I think with synthetic biology and all the AI tools and all these protein engineering progress that we have seen recently also in the Nobel Prize thing, I think the materials can have the decision-making ability. So they know when to interact, with what to interact, and where to interact.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Material Minds podcast, the place where we talk to the people exploring new materials for a better world. Today, we talk with Professor Luai Khoury from Technion, the Israel Institute of Technology. We talk about his research in developing protein-based materials. He creates sponges with catalytic activity, protein sponges with catalytic activity. He talks about making soft robots that can deliver drugs inside your body, inside your gut. And also about an espresso-inspired machine for making protein microgels. It was a very curious and bio-inspired conversation that we had. And I'm sure you're going to enjoy it too. So let's go ahead. Hi, Luai. Welcome to Material Minds.
Hi, Shrish. Thank you for having me today. It's a real pleasure to be at INMM and share with you what we do in the material science and engineering department at the Technion.
Yeah, I'm really curious to hear what about your background, what you do, and so on. And of course, we're going to start with our favorite game, Three Truths and a Lie. So you're going to tell me four statements. You prepared four statements.
Yeah.
You're going to tell me four statements, and I have to figure out which one is the lie. Three are going to be true, one's a lie. I have to figure it out. I'm going to ask you some questions in the middle, like after every statement, to try to poke into, find out the hidden meanings behind it or so on. And so, yeah, if you're ready, I'm ready for the first statement.
All right. Let's play the Three Truths and a Lie game. And I will try to be smart enough, like my materials, to fool you or to make it difficult for you to find the truth or the lie. So the first statement is, I once created a protein-based material or sponge that makes or keeps trypsin active for over 10 days. And I can use it for like 40 times for its application.
Okay, so you have a sponge. When you say sponge, and you like in terms of your material, your protein-based materials, when you say sponge, is this like a kitchen sponge that I can think of? Okay, it's going to be like a kitchen sponge. And you're saying trypsin is active. Is the trypsin within the sponge? Okay, the trypsin's within the sponge. What does the trypsin do?
Trypsin is an enzyme, digesting enzyme, that cleaves the proteins into protein fragments.
Okay, so trypsin basically cleaves other proteins. And so your application is probably to take it and cleave other proteins in some location. Is that the case?
Yeah.
Okay.
Almost.
Would you be willing to share what kind of proteins you want to cut with it, with the sponge?
We cut various kinds of proteins, small proteins, medium-sized proteins, and even a matrix of complex proteins such as serum.
Okay, so serum. So this would be for a biomedical application. Would
that be the case? Yeah.
Okay. So you have a sponge. It's got trypsin in it. Is trypsin attached to the sponge inside, or is it just floating around inside?
It's attached.
It's covalently attached. Covalently attached to the sponge. It's in there, and I guess the key factor is what you say. It's active for how many days?
For more than 10 days.
More than 10 days, and you can use it 40 times.
Yeah.
At least. That's a lot. Does the activity reduce over time, or do you have good activity all throughout?
It reduces, but not that much.
Okay. It reduces a bit, but it doesn't reduce that much. 40 times. That's a lot. I don't know of any enzymes that would act for that long. But trypsin, I guess, is a pretty stable enzyme or a pretty potent enzyme.
Okay, I'll have to think about this.
Okay.
So when you use it to break down enzymes, how long is one time when you say you're using it one time?
We incubate the sponge with a target protein for like about 12 hour minimum.
12 hour, and yeah. You can do this 40 times.
Yeah, we can take it out, put it back 40 times.
40. Okay, that's now making me doubt this statement. Okay, let's listen to your next ones.
Okay, and then, yeah. So I will try to make it more easy now. Mm-hmm. One of my hydrogel actuators, soft robots, mm-hmm. was inspired by origami.
Uh-huh.
And it can unfold autonomously inside the stomach.
Uh-huh.
For bioapplication or for drug release purposes.
Okay. So it's a soft robot. It's a protein-based material that can unfold on its own.
Mm-hmm.
What makes it unfold?
The triggers that exist in the environment where the robots exist.
Uh-huh.
For example, the stomach.
Uh-huh.
The acidity, the enzymes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the enzymes and the acidity in the stomach makes this soft robot-like protein material unfold.
Mm-hmm.
And then what does it do in there, in the stomach?
It can catch the mucin coating layer inside the stomach.
Okay.
So it can increase the retention time of this soft robot inside the stomach to be able to increase the availability of the drug, of the, the drug release inside the target site, inside the stomach.
Okay. And this was inspired by origami, you say?
Yeah.
What about origami kind of inspired? Is there a folding that's actually happening
at
the material level? Or is it more at the protein level?
Both.
Okay. Okay. So the pH changes, the material folds and unfolds, and you have somehow... Okay, how have you structured the material? How do you fabricate them?
We can use molds. We can use 3D printing.
Okay. 3D printing and molds. So to make this kind of origami folded structure, do you use 3D printing or molds rather? What works better?
3D printing,
okay. 3D printing. And if you say origami, I immediately start thinking of the origami crane. Is it a very complex structure that it folds into like that?
It's way more simple than origami, I think.
Okay.
The paper one, paper origami.
Okay.
It's a little bit more. Yeah, it's more simple, I think.
It's more simple. Yeah. Okay, but it's inspired by origami. Yeah. Okay. So the statement is basically that, this goes, it can go into your body, it can fold or unfold in a certain way, and then stick inside your gut and deliver drugs.
Yeah.
For how long do you have a feeling?
Maybe for one cycle of food, like one digesting cycle.
Because the pH changes the enzymes disappear? Okay.
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
I didn't think about the enzyme disappear, but maybe, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. Okay. This sounds like it could be something that is true. But okay, let's go on to your third statement.
Okay. My third statement.
Mm-hmm.
We developed a system
mm-hmm.
that we called it APMIS for mm-hmm. synthesizing functional hydrogel microparticles
mm-hmm.
or protein-based microgels.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the system was inspired by the process of brewing espresso.
Okay. So the process of brewing espresso. What is APMIS?
APMIS is aided porous emulsification, porous medium emulsification system.
Aided porous medium emulsification system. And I'm trying to see how that connects with espresso.
Yeah.
What in the espresso preparation is related to this APMIS?
What happens in the espresso, you can have emulsification inside the grinded coffee capsule.
Uh-huh.
Where water flows into this grinded particles, between the grinded particles,
uh-huh.
and it collects the oil of the coffee. And inside this capsule or inside this porous medium of the grinded coffee,
mm-hmm.
the both phases of water and oil mix, making the emulsion, making droplets of coffee oil inside uh-huh. the whole phase of water. So
okay.
These micro droplets that you happens there between due to the mixing of water and coffee oils
uh-huh.
mix this brewing process.
Okay. Now I'm getting a little bit better. Yeah. So you have in your system what you said the APMIS system. Then you're going to use it to make microparticles mm-hmm. or microgels, mm-hmm. I guess what you said. And the APMIS system basically uses this espresso idea and mixes oil and water into an emulsion.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the case?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Uh-huh. What is it that allows it to mix? Because I know quite a few different ways in which you can mix oil. I mean, you can just take oil and water, mix it really, just by hand or vortexing it in
mm-hmm.
and have a detergent in there. And then, you know, you have an emulsion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's used a lot in food, you know, different mm-hmm. ways of preparing these kind of things. So what is special in this espresso method that you were
what is this? What is special and unique about this method that we are able to make functional protein microgels in seconds instead of waiting for minutes or hours?
Okay.
And then it's a cheap system that uh-huh. can be scalable, as I said, cost effective.
Yeah.
Very simple to handle and work with.
Okay.
And it's the production rate of this system is very high.
Okay, can I ask, maybe this goes a bit deeper into it, but if it doesn't give away the truth or the lie, can I ask, what is it that actually forces these oil and water to mix and form droplets? So is it a vortexing thing or is it like a microfluidic thing or I don't know.
Yeah, to what makes them mix inside the...
What makes them mix and then but then form these droplets?
It's because water and oil doesn't mix
mm-hmm.
at all. So whenever they meet each other in the porous medium...
They're in a porous medium. So yeah,
The two phases meet in the porous structure.
Uh-huh.
And there the emulsion starts to happen.
Okay.
Exactly as the water goes into the coffee grind. And where you start to have your coffee in the pot.
Okay. Well, I have to confess I don't drink coffee, so I'm very illiterate about coffee-related processes. But of course, I've seen coffee machines and so on. Porous medium. I think I missed that when I was thinking of the other stuff. When you say porous medium, is this connecting to your first statement about sponges? Do you use those sponges or how does that work?
Actually, the porous and the sponges are similar a bit.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't think about this before. But
Okay. So then you don't use your sponges to make these.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now I'm telling you what is okay.
can you say what actually you use as the porous medium?
Use polyethylene FRITS.
FRITS, okay. Yeah. So the things that we have in columns at the bottom.
Exactly.
And those are porous. What sizes are these pores approximately?
It depends on the making of the FRITS itself, on the particles that were centered inside the FRIT.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember, but it's in micro-sized.
Micron-sized, okay.
Yeah, micro-sized tunnels or pores.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, micron-sized. And so then the microgels that you get, are they also micron-sized?
Yes.
Like, I mean,
in micro,
really small microns?
From 5 to 40.
5 to 40 microns. So it's pretty small. And is it
mono-dispersed?
Like, is there a wide range of distributions?
It depends on how fast you pass the two phases through the porous medium.
Okay.
And it depends on the tortuosity of the porous medium.
Okay.
It depends also on the...
The tortuosity. Tortuosity.
How complex is the structure, microstructure of the fret? What is the path length that the particle needs to pass through to pass from one side to another?
Huh.
If the tortuosity is too high, it takes more time. The particle will be more like
retained inside. Yeah.
And be exposed to more shear stress as well.
That
affects the mechanics of the particle formation and the particle size.
Okay. So this higher tortuosity gives you smaller particles, or
yes.
is it correlated that way?
Yeah. Okay. You can see that.
Okay. Okay. So I think I've dug in quite deep into this one, but it's very fascinating.
Yeah.
I really like it. Maybe one last question. So you said it's like espresso. Mm-hmm. Is it also like something that you push?
Is it
a pressure-based thing?
Yeah, you can push it by pressure, yes, of course.
Okay, so it's very close to this coffee machine idea.
Yeah. We do it also maybe. We can maybe do it with centrifuge. What?
You can do it with centrifuge, okay. But you can also press and... I have heard a lot about different kind of microparticle, microgel. There's a lot of microfluidics related work on making these kind of micro droplets and nano droplets and so on.
Right.
And I'm wondering, like, those technologies are quite complex, right? Quite complex, mm-hmm. relatively expensive. And yeah, you make very kind of same size droplets very reproducibly. Yeah. And what you're saying is that it's much faster, and if it's just a fret and like pushing like oil and water through it and so on, that sounds like much cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're saying you get pretty good size distribution.
Yeah, pretty good. Not like microfluidic.
Uh-huh.
But way more fast and cheap and effective than microfluidic.
Okay. Interesting. It's difficult for me to judge if this is a truth or a lie because on the one hand, I also know you can just mix oil and water in a certain way and you get some kind of droplets. I mean, you don't have much control over the process there. And on the other hand, you have microfluidics that give you complete control, but they're super expensive and so on. And I'm really struggling to wonder if just having a porous medium and pushing oil and water through it actually does the job.
We will know.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to your fourth statement.
Yeah. The fourth statement is, I once printed a protein-based material.
Uh huh.
That I tested it in the International Space Station.
Okay.
The aim was to, in the future, to take it to the outer space.
Uh huh.
And see how the zero gravity conditions affect these materials.
So it's been tested in the International Space Station right now?
We want to.
Okay.
Yeah, and the aim is to test it in, in zero gravity conditions out of, in the space.
But it's not been to space yet?
Not yet, but that's the dream. We have the material. We know how it will behave. But
why? What advantage does it provide in space? Why do we need
zero gravity conditions? Mm-hmm. The stiffness of the material, how it will change the swelling behavior, the actuating.
Oh, so this is one of your soft robot materials.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we want to see how all these conditions affect this behavior of actuating behavior.
Okay, in zero gravity. Would it have a specific application in space?
First of all, let's see what happens with it compared to what happens in the lab here on Earth.
Okay, uh-huh.
That would be interesting.
Do you already have a contact to take it out to space?
We are able to mimic the situation, the conditions.
Are you mimicking it in the lab?
In the lab, but in the institute where I work.
In the institute, you're able to mimic zero gravity conditions on Earth. How does that work?
We just use centrifugation-based system to make the zero gravity or... And I'm not familiar with what they are doing. I just give the material.
Okay. And they do it by themselves. Then there is a way to actually mimic the zero gravity condition and you see what happens. Are you able to see the material when it's under
the... They film it for us.
They film it. Okay.
Yeah, they film it. We don't experience the same conditions that the gel is experiencing of no gravity thing, no gravity forces.
Yeah. Do you already know what happens in these kind of zero gravity conditions?
I know that we can
does it still fold the way?
We're still working on this.
Uh huh.
But I think it will fold better than with when there is a gravity.
When there is gravity. Okay. Okay. That's nice.
That's what I think.
Yeah, interesting. So it's a material you have printed already. You have tested.
Yeah, 3D printer using our 3D printer in the lab, and yeah, that's what we.
Okay, and you want to send it to space?
Yeah.
Is there already a plan to have it in space? Like, is there a timeline?
Still not, but okay. We are still checking investigating how it behaves in similar condition in labs.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Okay, so that's the fourth statement. Let me recap through your other statements from the start. So the first statement is that you have a protein-based sponge,
mm-hmm.
right? It has trypsin, and the trypsin is active for 40 cycles for more than 10 days,
mm-hmm.
which seems like a lot. Okay, the next one is an origami-based folding material that can go into your... that can go into your stomach and release drugs. It can mm-hmm. attach to your stomach and then release drugs.
Mm-hmm.
The third one is your espresso APMES
mm-hmm.
System in which you can make microgels. And the fourth one is a 3D printed material that you want to send to space.
Right.
And you've tested it under zero gravity conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm kind of doubtful about statement one and statement four, actually. One, because, I mean, I do work quite a bit with enzymes. And it's very difficult to believe this 40-day thing. 10 days, 40 cycles thing. And number four, which is the zero gravity stuff. I mean... It could be true, although it was the one where you gave me the least amount of details, I feel. But I also didn't probe it too much. I want to say statement four. Is that the lie?
Right.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Unfortunately, none of my materials have reached space yet.
Okay.
But if NASA is interested...
Okay. So NASA, if you're listening,
I will give them some samples.
Awesome.
Maybe they can try them there, see how it works.
Really cool. Yeah. But I'm going to get back to your first statement because I was almost going to go for that as the lie because it didn't sound possible. Right? Like, what is it that's now, you have the sponge. What is the sponge made of? How is the trypsin attached to it? And why is it active for so long?
The sponge is made out of proteins. Especially uh-huh. albumin and trypsin.
Uh-huh.
And we mix them with Tween 20, which is a surfactant.
Uh-huh.
A very biocompatible surfactant to proteins, so it will not affect the structure of the proteins.
Uh-huh.
And we use also photo cross-linkers, such as APS, ammonium persulfate, and the ruthenium.
Uh-huh.
And whenever we mix all these compounds together, and we use a homogenizer, we make a foam. Then we take the foam, we expose it to white light.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a photocovalent, photo cross-linking reaction
uh-huh.
where we cross-link between the tyrosine amino acids that exist on the surface of the proteins that is inside the hydrogel precursor.
Okay.
So trypsin will be covalently attached to BSA,
uh-huh.
and BSA will be attached also to other BSAs and trypsins.
Okay.
And the foaming process will make this sponge structure due to the air that is entrapped in the solution during the foaming.
Okay.
So we make the foam, make the porous structure of the foam.
Yeah.
Then we expose the whole foam to white light. So we cross-link covalently all the compounds, all uh-huh. the proteins together. At the end, we have this sponge.
Okay.
So the trypsin is covalently embedded inside the sponge, which increases its stability.
Uh-huh.
And activity.
Uh-huh. Increase,
it's not active as a free trypsin because some uh-huh. of the active sites of trypsin will be not accessible to proteins due to their random mixing.
Uh-huh.
But we can keep it working for longer time than free trypsin in a solution.
Okay.
So it's a trade-off.
Yeah, okay. Okay, interesting. So the more you talked about foam, the more I was thinking about your espresso point. And is this also coffee inspired? Because you have
Actually no. It was just the aim or the vision was how can we make a spongy or highly porous protein-based material?
How is the foam made then, actually? Like, how do you get the air in?
We just mix with a homogenizer.
Ah, okay. And
like,
then
as you mix...
In baking.
Exactly.
You know how you get
the air. Exactly. So you, as you make the meringue.
Okay.
Yeah, you just.
So yeah, you also said albumin, which is, you know, very much like the eggs albumin, I suppose. Yeah. Is it the same albumin?
It's very similar.
It's very similar. Okay.
Yeah, but exactly, yes.
Okay.
You foam.
Yeah.
But the protein can foam by itself, but also to help it with the tween, the surfactant, to make this kind of air entrapment.
Okay.
Inside the material.
Interesting. Yeah. So your third statement was espresso food related. This first statement also has a food related connection, which is quite interesting to see.
Right.
But getting back to the point a little bit. So your trypsin is trapped in there, and that is what stabilizes it and keeps it active for that long.
Yes. Exactly. It's not fully active. I have to say, as free trypsin.
Yeah.
It's
sure.
Not accessible as free trypsin, but it stays there for a longer time.
That's
so. Whenever you immerse the sponge, you can take it out, wash it, and use it again.
Okay.
Free trypsin, you cannot do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the only.
So what you said, you could use it for serum and so on. What is the actual application you're going for with this?
We can use it for digesting, for catalysis, for like digesting oils, for example. For lipids.
Yeah.
For many other applications. It's a concept.
Yeah.
We start with something.
Okay.
And after that, we learn the system as material engineers.
Yeah. Okay.
We learn the limitations. We learn the capabilities of our platform.
Yeah.
And then we start to take it one step left, one step
right. Yeah. Okay.
To see what can we do it.
So basically, you can have other enzymes inside.
Yes.
If you're talking about lipids, if you're talking about oils, and so on.
Yeah. That's the plan.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
but what is nice about proteins or enzymes, which is a subclass of protein, that each one of them behaves differently.
Yeah.
And that's one of the challenges.
That's what keeps life exciting.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true. Okay, so the first statement was that, and that's really fascinating that it keeps trypsin active for so long, and you have this much activity still after repeated uses.
Mm-hmm.
How big are your sponges, actually?
We can mold them in any size.
Any size?
Yeah.
Is there a limitation in terms of the foaming or so?
I think so. Whenever you start to make them like this size, you need different tools.
Okay.
But we can reach like almost like this size.
Okay. So a few centimeters.
Yeah, you also want to make it go inside the falcon that exists.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
You cannot make it too big and you cannot make it too small.
True.
So,
Okay, interesting. Then the next one that you talked about was your soft robot, right? Mm-hmm. Like the soft robot made of proteins. And you said that there are these triggers like pH and so on that make it fold.
Mm-hmm.
What is it in the pH that actually makes the whole thing fold?
Well, let me start with the first thing about... The most important thing about proteins, as you also know, that proteins are existing in their folded state in physiological conditions, in their normal state.
Mm-hmm.
When you expose a protein for like different triggers or conditions, such as acidity, such as light, such as enzymes, salts, high salt, solution with high salt high concentration of salt, the proteins their structure can be interrupted.
Okay.
Disrupted.
Disrupted, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And they can deform.
Deform, okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Or denature. Like,
They unfold.
They totally unfold.
Uh-huh.
But what is nice about proteins that thermodynamically, whenever you just release them from this trigger, they know how to remember Okay. And go to their initial state.
So they remember their original shape.
Exactly.
And just from the basics, basically these proteins are chains of amino acids.
Right.
They remember their original shape when they're in the right conditions that's suitable for them.
Exactly.
And if you change the conditions, now they unfold.
Exactly.
And this translates into like a macro scale folding in your material.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly.
Is it similar, like the soft robotics kind of thing that you said, is it a similar kind of structure as what you explained with the sponges, that it's attached to a polymer and so on?
Actually, yes. We incorporate or we embed the proteins inside a passive hydrogel matrix.
Okay.
We can use different polymers.
Uh-huh.
These days we are focusing on PEGDA, polyethylene glycol dacrylate.
Uh-huh.
And we can do that with any protein matrix.
Okay.
But some of the proteins, as I mentioned, they are passive. They don't react or they don't respond to triggers in the environment.
Yeah.
But proteins has this nature ability.
Uh-huh.
Inherently. They inherently has this smartness.
Yeah.
So that's how we combine these two worlds.
Interesting.
In order to control the, exactly as you described it, to control the actuating behavior through the actuating behavior of the protein itself.
Wow. So something happens at the nanoscale and you see it translate into the macro scale.
Exactly.
By what you see by eye.
The scientists developed this before with polymers, like thermoresponsive polymers, many polymers. But you need to design the polymer to have this property.
Yeah.
Proteins, you don't even...
They're already designed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Plus, you can design them more, I suppose, nowadays. Like, you can tune their design with a lot of these AI tools and so on that have come out.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah, a lot of potential then with the developments that are coming up, for sure. Yeah. Cool. So, so there's all of these examples are with proteins, which kind of brings me to the segment of what is your favorite material? Is it something protein?
Our favorite material is for sure proteins.
Uh-huh.
Especially what we are working on these days a lot.
Yeah.
Is a cheap protein that is really abundant in our plasma, which is BSA. In our plasma, it's a human serum albumin.
Yeah.
But we mostly use bovine serum albumin.
Uh-huh.
They are very similar, but there are some amino acids that are different in both proteins.
Uh-huh.
But this is our main protein in the lab.
Okay, so for our listeners...
We try with it everything.
Wonderful.
We start with it every application.
Yeah.
And after we see how it works, we move toward more complex, more expensive, more...
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, low abundant or rare proteins that we can have.
Can you, just for our listeners, can you just describe what you're holding there?
This is a BSA in its powder state, crystals.
Mm-hmm. In a glass vial.
Yeah, it's in a glass vial. It's not that harmful, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Is it protein like how, you know, if I talk to someone at the gym and they say, you know, eat a lot of protein?
This exists in the blood, though.
Yeah.
Of cows, you know.
Okay, so if you really good healthy stuff.
Yeah, if you eat a steak, buy steak, you get some proteins.
Ah, okay.
Albumins, other proteins, you know.
And is that why it's also so cost effective for you to use?
Like, yes, because
it's very abundant?
Yes, yes. BSA is what is unique about it. It's very stable.
Uh-huh.
It has a diverse biochemical structure.
Yeah.
It can interact with many molecules inside the body, like small molecules, protein fragments. It's a carrier, and it has a long half life time for about 21 days.
Okay, so in the body.
Yeah, so it's very stable.
Interesting.
So
yeah,
it
nice.
Can interact with many other. It can be functionalized.
Yeah,
it's enough big. Like it's about 67 kilodaltons.
Okay.
So you can use the diverse structure of the surface of BSA.
Okay.
Be able to functionalize it with different polymers.
Wow. Okay.
So that's why we use it. We start with it. We start every experiment or every material with BSA.
Nice, yeah. So it's a relatively cheap protein.
Yeah.
It's stable. It actually ticks a lot of boxes. It's stable within the body. You're able to bind other proteins to it, and then it has this folding, unfolding property.
Exactly. That's really what I forgot. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's a globular structure.
It's a globular structure. Okay.
Yeah, it's like a sphere structure protein.
Okay.
Which can, as you describe it, it can be unfolded or refolded.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice, wonderful. Because I know BSA quite a lot also. Like anytime anyone who works in biology uses BSA as, you know, just this background protein for, you know, you put it in cell culture, you put it in, for protein purification, you have it also in materials, in biomaterial science, right. You have it in the background to prevent things from sticking to other things in the body. So it's such a commonly used protein, but you make such advanced materials out of it that can form sponges and soft robots.
That's what I want, yeah.
So that actually brings me to actually the final part of this. You're making these really cool protein-based materials that can, you know, change shape, that can be active as sponges, that can form microgels and so on, and maybe one day go into space. So if you think of, you know, whatever research you're doing, everything works out, it's working beautifully, and, you know, 20 years in the future, you've got protein materials out in the world. What would you envision the world being like at that point? Like, what would these materials be out there doing?
I think where the future is heading is toward materials where are not any longer passive.
Mm-hmm.
They will be very interactive materials.
Mm-hmm.
They will be these materials will be responsive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with synthetic biology and all the AI tools and all these protein engineering progress that we have seen recently also in the Nobel Prize thing.
Yeah.
I think the materials can have the decision-making ability.
Oh.
So they know when to interact, with what to interact, and where to interact.
Okay.
They can decide. Proteins can be very smart with time and all this AI tools that they decide if it's the right time to interact with molecules or just be passive. Now it's not the time to do the function that I'm designed to do it.
Okay.
So that's what I think where the smartness of proteins together with the smartness of the science that we are trying to improve these days.
Yeah.
I think it will go to materials that they can just decide by themselves.
Wow, that's fascinating. So it's not just computers with AI and so on that are getting smarter and smarter, but our materials are also going to be incredibly smart.
Yeah. So some of the materials that exist today are really smart.
Uh-huh.
They just respond to specific triggers in a specific environment. For example, for drug release in cancer tumors. This is very, they stay passive until they reach the site of the tumor, then they start to be active.
Mm.
This kind of decision-making material.
Yeah, yeah.
But we can improve it way more just to release it and forget about it.
Uh-huh.
And it can and just, yeah.
It can do multiple functions and do know when to do those functions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's going to be very exciting to see in the future.
Yeah, and also I'm thinking one thing that is really the future is going, where I see the future is really advancing with protein materials or with material science in general, is to make the materials inside the body.
Make the material inside the body. Uh-huh.
Already now there's a kind of amazing achievements of printing.
Yeah.
The printing inside the body.
Oh, wow.
So you don't need to print.
You mean in a surgery sort of setting and so on.
Yes, in situ, on demand.
Ah, okay.
To have a system that you just print or form the material inside your stomach or inside on your heart or anywhere in your body without any like preparations before or in the lab or any pre processes that you need to do, and you can save time shorten the surgery time. I think this is what is really going to be interesting in the next 10 years, to be able to form it in situ.
Wow. And do you, coming back to the point where you said they would be smart and they would be able to make decisions, do you think that these materials that you print in the body would also be smart enough somehow to know, okay, this is where it's going to form a certain tissue. At a certain time, it's going to change its mechanical property.
Exactly.
You know, to fit certain regenerative processes.
I think that's
everyone,
every material scientist.
Yeah, okay.
and if we, and I think the material science in general is the key for many problems that we will face in the future.
Yeah.
Especially in agriculture with water.
Yeah.
So okay. They already designed gels that can use to for plants to grow plants and trees and many things. So I think if we can make them more smart, that they can be adaptable to many environmental conditions, that's something that will help to improve the future of every application.
Wonderful. Yeah. That sounds really interesting. So the future is a future of protein-based bio-intelligent materials that are smart enough to enhance all sorts of applications, biomedical, agro.
Yeah, but it depends also. It's not possible without all the tools that synthetic biology, AI, are introducing to science these days. We need to make the proteins more scalable, highly with high production rates.
Yeah,
and you know that better than me. So
yeah, that is a challenge. But yeah, of course, this question is mainly about having a fantasy of the future, imagining the future as a fantasy. If you know what your research, what you're developing in your research actually all works out, and it's technologically scalable, then
one curious question, make me curious about it is, when we made polymers from molecules, now we can make materials from proteins.
Yeah.
What is the next materials? What are the next molecules that can we make out of them? Like this, I mean, biomolecules.
Yeah. Interesting.
Something different with, I don't know.
There's polysaccharides, there's different lipids, various
what can we invent? What we can produce more?
Yeah, it's a fascinating world that we have ahead exploring. And I think I learned a lot in this conversation. I think it was very fascinating. I think your statements were very well crafted. I'm happy I was able to find the lie. And I'm happy that your other statements were very true. It was very interesting to learn about that. So thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah,
it's a real pleasure. I enjoyed it a lot. Very nice experience.
Wonderful. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm sure our viewers and listeners have also enjoyed this entire conversation. We're on YouTube, we're on Spotify, we're on Apple, we're everywhere. So find us, follow us, like, subscribe, all of that, and look forward to the next one. See you.
See you. Bye.